Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Queen's University of Charlotte announces plans to merge with Elon University sometime next year. Details are still sketchy, but the Queen's president put it simply.
Elon and Queen's are stronger together.
More controversy swirling around Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden with charges of retaliation leveled against him. The U.S. House Judiciary Committee is planning a road trip to hold hearings on crime in Charlotte following the recent murder on the Blue Line. And there are developments at the local and state level to talk about that as well. A winner is declared in the District 5 council race. COVID-19 vaccine confusion continues, and Charlotte FC is set to make history this weekend. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE politics reporter Steve Harrison. Alexandria Sands is with us. She's a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And last but certainly not least, Eric Spanberger is here. He is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Sorry we have a slow news week.
Sorry. We'll try to cram it all in. We'll slow down. We'll talk slowly this morning. The announcement this week seemed to come out of absolutely nowhere, out of the blue, but was obviously in the planning stages for a while, the planned merger of Queen's University of Charlotte with Elon University.
Together, we will strengthen the talent pipeline, workforce readiness, future leaders, and civic life for this great city. Simply put, Elon and Queen's are stronger together.
Queen's University interim president Jesse Curtin. Was this, Eric, the best kept secret ever? Or has anybody heard murmurings of this prior to the announcement?
This was a pretty well-kept secret to the point, Mike, that I was speaking to someone who was involved in the public relations on this story. And this person said to me, I can't believe it didn't get out. She was just shocked that this did not leak. They had been in talks for, I believe they said, 4 months that this had been in the works. And it was certainly a surprise to me. You have two private schools, one with in Queens with about 1,900 students and Elon with about 7,300 students. And I'm sure we'll get into this, but there's a lot of pressure on colleges and particularly private colleges right now. And I think that's motivating a lot of what we saw.
So this merger is scheduled to take place before the start of the next school year. And by next summer, they say that Elon will, quote, operate Queens in partnership with existing and legacy leaders, whatever that means. This has to go through an approval process, Alex. Who has to approve?
Yeah, they're still figuring out the structure of the merger. So they're going to be doing that between now and November. Then they have to finalize the agreement in December. And then this will all be official in June. So it seems like Elon will mostly be operating Queens. When they're talking about that legacy, like the legacy that you spoke of, it seems like that means they're going to keep mostly the Elon board, which is 37 members, and then they're going to add on 10 members from Queen's board. So it's going to be pretty Elon dominant, and then that board will be in place. The Queen's board will stay in place through 2029, but then they will merge into that 47-member board.
So Queen's University's interim president says this move was to expand options for students. But according to reporting by WFAE education reporter James Farrell, financial findings indicate that Queen's had more than $88 million in revenue in 2023, the most recent year for which figures are available, but $109 million worth of expenses. I did the math. That's a deficit. But Queens also had $189 million in assets versus only $122 million in liabilities. So that's the plus column. Elon looks healthier on paper with larger assets, $1.2 billion in assets. Is this about Queens trying to stave off financial trouble, or more about strengthening options for students and ensuring a permanent place for this school in Charlotte?
Depends who you ask, Mike. Jesse Cureton, the interim president who you just played the clip of, said that they're in a perfectly strong position, but this was a move toward the future. The numbers that you just read indicate everything's not great. The number that jumps out at me is that between 2011 and 2024, their enrollment has gone down by 37%. They attribute a large part of that to the end of a nursing program in 2014. But whatever the reason, when you're already looking at a school that's very small and then you see that kind of enrollment dip, you have to be concerned. And as I mentioned earlier, for private schools, I mean, it is an increasingly tough slog. I was looking last night, Mike, as I was doing the homework you'd assigned me. So all-in costs for a year at Elon or Queens are roughly between $60,000 and $75,000. For UNC Chapel Hill, NC State, UNCC, you're talking about $27,000, $28,000 a year. So you can see, you know, that's a much different audience that you are trying to appeal to.
Well, according to the Business Journal, I believe you're familiar with that publication.
Yes.
an undergraduate degree at Queens costs about $65,151 a year before student aid or scholarships might kick in. For an undergraduate degree at Elon is a mere $48,216 a year. And this is this kind of money is being asked at a time, as you point out, of decreasing enrollment, not just at those schools, but at colleges overall, because a lot of young people are looking at their predecessors' staggering debt and thinking, I'll make more money as a plumber or an electrician, and they are taking a different track. They're not taking a college track. Nationwide enrollment has dipped 10%. Enrollment at Queens dropped 13% last year, 12% last year, at Elon. Will a merger address those problems? I'm not sure who to ask that question of.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it is the ultimate question. I don't know that anybody has an answer. I think that the way they probably came to the conclusion they came to is they're stronger together than apart, and they can combine those resources, obviously, and offer more majors, more programs to get students into school and keep them in school. And remember, with Elon in particular, you now have the law school that they opened in Charlotte in 2024, and they're about to start the physician's assistant program in Charlotte in 2027. So they're trying to boost enrollment by offering courses and majors in fields where there are deficits or lack of workers. That all makes sense. But as you say, it is a difficult road out there with colleges, and we haven't even gotten to the demographic cliff. Although the interesting thing about that is the demographic cliff of people having fewer children since the Great Recession, while that is forecast for the next 15 years, when you look at North Carolina, because so many people are coming into the state, you don't see the same drop-off. So, you know, it's hard to predict, but it is clear by this action that they felt like they had to do something.
Mary. And so many students, yes, aren't going to college. It's not just the debt, but it's no longer the case that a college degree is the guarantee of a job. So they have, on the one hand, this debt. On the other hand, they have a job at Starbucks or something. And some of the fields that used to be guaranteed a job, like, oh, computer programming, these things, you see AI having a big effect on that. And so colleges are doing this, and universities, for their own survival, because you have, you know, certain level of colleges that will always, the so-called elite schools, have folks vying to get in, and other schools just really trying to keep up their enrollment when students are looking at them, as you and Eric have said, Mike, with a jaundiced eye, like, why do I need this, this, and to go in all this debt, and maybe I won't have a job in my chosen field.
And students coming out of college right now are facing historic problems in finding that first job after college. Former Bank of America CEO and chairman Hugh McCall, whose name is on the Queen's University of Charlotte Business School, says, quote, "This is going to turn out to be one of the most important things to ever happen in Charlotte." That is saying a lot. On what does he base that?
I am assuming that he's basing that on preserving and strengthening a university in Queens that's been here 170 years. It's a big part of the fabric of the city. Whether he's right, I have to go to the ultimate journalism cop-out. Only time will tell.
or as we say in broadcasting, stay tuned. There
but
are
exactly. alums, but some Queens alums also are kind of a little worried because, you know, our mayor, Mayor Vi Lyles, is an alum, and it does have a quite a long tradition, and they're wondering if it will be sort of gobbled up and you really, you know, it'll be Elon Queens.
Yeah, and one of the other alums is our newly elected council person, evidently newly elected council person in District 5. And he's expressed some, and we'll talk about him later, but he's expressed some reservations about this. We still don't know the name of the school once this merger goes through. What do we know about athletics? Not the names of the teams necessarily, but the fact that Queens just touted the fact that they reached Division I all of a sudden.
Yeah,
and now what?
I'm glad you mentioned that, Mike, because, of course, when you go to Division I, that's much more expensive. They're just now starting to absorb those costs because their stint in Division I began with the current school year. Elon has 17 men's and women's sports. Queens has 28. And for now, they're saying that those will remain entirely separate and they will remain fully intact. That is something to keep an eye on, though, because, as I mentioned, athletics are very expensive. They're obviously very prominent and very important to alums and students. But if things grow more difficult, would that be an area where they cut? That would be one to watch.
Many people don't know this, but Queens used to have a theater department, which they phased out in recent years. Elon, on the other hand, has one of the nation's preeminent musical theater programs. They turn out tons of successful graduates in that field. What do we know about that, Alex? Is this going to expand artistic horizons in Charlotte for students at Queens?
Possibly. I know that students, they're going to be able to immediately be able to take courses at the other school. Another big benefit to the Elon students, especially in Charlotte, is that they can now use all the Queens facilities, like the library, so they're no longer just contained to that South End building if they're in law school here. So that could be a huge benefit to the Elon students especially.
And getting back, Alex, to the name of the school, it's clearly not going to be Queens University of Charlotte anymore, but several people have said they would like some part of that, probably the Queens part of that, to remain part of the name. Have we heard any inkling about how they might handle that?
Mm-hmm. I know that we know that Queens will be part of the new name. I was trying to brainstorm myself. I don't know how they're going to be able to do it, if they're going to be able to combine Elon and Queens together.
Sure, the Queens like campus of Elon University.
Yeah. I mean, there's also there's the lion mascot, but I think there's over 3,000 alumni here in Charlotte, and they're going to have a listening tour to talk about all these things. That's going to start next month. And I think that they're going to show out in full force because, like everybody said, there's a long legacy here, over 160 years. So they're going to want to keep that identity if they can.
And the number of alumni at Queens is important, but the number of alumni at Elon is greater. And one of the things I heard talked about, and I only have 30 seconds left, it was that this expands the alumnus base. Because when you get out of college, it's who you know. And alumni are an important part of getting that first job or that second job or that third job. Do you think that will come true? Do you think that Elon alumni will look at Queens alumni now that they're married and with the same consideration?
I mean, it depends how Elon handles this. Are they going to be nice and consider Queens' feelings? We'll see.
When we come back, we're going to talk about Sheriff Gary McFadden. Yes, that McFadden. He's back in the news. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks. I'm the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison, our political reporter at WFAE News, is with us, along with Mary C. Curtis, host of the Equal Time podcast produced by RollCall.com, where she's also a columnist. Alexandria Sands is here from Axios Charlotte, and Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal for a couple of years now. Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden has been embroiled in a series of controversies about his alleged treatment of department personnel. And we have witnessed several very public resignations in which the people resigning have published public letters decrying McFadden's conduct. Well, now the department's former business director, Angelia, I hope I say this name correct, Rigsby, is suing McFadden and the department. Steve, what is this suit about?
Yeah, she filed a lawsuit a week ago, and she said that McFadden, quote, created a toxic culture of retaliation and racism within the sheriff's department. She said she was told to fabricate expense reports, or, you know, to clean them up, I guess. And like you said, Mike, this is kind of the latest human resources controversy within the sheriff's office. If you go back several years, a lot of the old holdovers from the previous sheriff, Urban Carmichael, blasted Gary McFadden. He kind of said, look, that was the old regime. He's now put in his own people, and many of them have left as well. Hmm.
She's bringing this suit in federal court. Why?
That I am not sure. I assume it's due to federal employment law and civil rights, et cetera. Okay. That would be my guess, but I did not cover the story in detail.
So she says that the sheriff created a toxic culture of retaliation and racism. He's black, she's black. That should be pointed out. But retaliation and racism within the sheriff's department. And her former position, in that former position, she reviewed the salaries and expenses of employees, and she alleges that she found several employees being paid for work that they did not perform. And she says she notified Sheriff McFadden and highlighted racial pay discrepancies that she discovered. 5 weeks later, she says, she was fired.
I need justice. I need to be heard. I need for everyone to know that I was doing what was right. I was standing for what was right.
Again, she found what she believes were racial pay disparities, and she found that a black woman in a managerial role in the sheriff's office was making less than three supervisors with less experience, less responsibility, and fewer years in the office. And she says she advised the sheriff that if that disparity was not addressed, there could be problems. He failed to make that adjustment. And she says the sheriff also asked her to alter governmental records following a public records request by the Charlotte Observer. She says she refused to do so because she thought it was illegal, and ultimately she was fired, and now she's saying that's retaliation. How difficult, Steve, is that to prove?
It will be, well, it's a good question in terms of whether, I don't know what kind of documents, if any, that she kept, any recordings that she kept or possibly made. I don't know how much detail she has, but her word obviously will go a long way in this lawsuit in determining whether, you know, her claims have merit.
Eric.
I think it'll also be interesting, and Mike, you alluded to this earlier, you know, you have the former deputy, what's it, Kevin Canty, and then mm-hmm. his replacement, Christopher Allen, who both wrote and spoke out pretty harshly about working in Sheriff McFadden's administration, and how much their words and their experiences factor into this case and consideration by the court. That will be, I would think, a pretty important factor as well.
Whether or not she can prove her allegations, some of her other comments echo those, as you just pointed out, of previous employees who left the department and who made allegations that McFadden has consistently denied. This time, McFadden released a 12-minute video statement taking issue with accusations of his creating that toxic work environment.
I feel betrayed. I feel that my loyalty was betrayed, my trust in my staff was betrayed, and most of all, the betrayal that my wife felt when I told her who said what and what was said and by whom.
He says he feels he's helped his employees during his tenure at the department and that the words being used by former employees are just wrong.
And you hear them saying words like narcissist and godlike and all of that. What they should be saying is progressive, innovative, forward-thinking, always direct, and always clear.
Just as the allegations from the series of employees who have left the sheriff's department all have similarities, his response to all of these allegations each time have similarities too. What he just said echoes what he said on this program months ago in talking about his leadership style, which does not sit well with some people. So, Alex, are these allegations more than disgruntled former employees airing dirty laundry in public?
I mean, McFadden is known to have a strong personality. He is a former reality TV star. People do have problems with leadership. I think that the main issue in this is that the thing that they're going to be able to prove, and I think the reason that Rigsby is the one that's going to court, is the pay disparity. You can easily see if a Black woman is being paid less in the same position with the same or more or less experience than her white colleagues who are men. So I think that'll be the most important thing. I think, and also with the public records, I mean, McFadden did eventually release those. I don't know how big that will be. He did include some notes. The records were related to travel expenses. And I believe when he gave them to the Observer, he ended up just adding notes saying, kind of explaining the expenses. So to me, that kind of, his hesitancy there may have been concern over what would be reported, maybe without context. But that could be easily addressed by just the Observer's going to ask for comment before, hopefully they would ask for comment before they put a story out. At that point, McFadden should have said, these are what those expenses were for.
Eric.
I think Alex makes a really good point that, you know, when you start to get into pay, when you start to get into work protocol and how people interact, they're is very likely to be a long paper trail, text messages, communications, those kinds of things that a court can go through and then decide, you know, who's right and who's wrong. So there is a lot to work with, assuming that this does, you know, proceed on and go to trial.
And Steve, we now have a pattern of accusations and a pattern of denials that have emerged over the course of several years. The sheriff is an elected position. So he cannot be removed by the county commission or anyone else for that matter. The way to remove him would be through the next election, whenever that is. But the courts could also get involved in that. Is any entity, aside from this, the people involved in this lawsuit, looking at the veracity of all these claims collectively? Because it is troubling if they're at all true.
Not that I'm aware of. And Mike, you mentioned, you know, that the sheriff is an elected position. Mecklenburg County is responsible for funding the sheriff's office. However, the county commission has not really taken an interest in any of the allegations or questioned McFadden about how his office is running.
Is that because they can't remove him? They can't discipline him?
You know, I think perhaps, but they have just funded the office. I mean, they have just not taken a lot of interest in getting involved. He was first elected in 2018, was reelected in 2022. And in that year, a lot of these allegations were on the table as well. I mean, under previous employees. I mean, this is not a new thing. He won the Democratic primary in 2022 against two challengers. He got 51% of the vote. This year, he already has three challengers who've lined up to run against him in the March primary. He has not said whether he'll run. It will be interesting to see if all of these stories, all of the negativity, if it finally kind of breaks through to voters. There is a high bar. I mean, we saw it in City Council District 3. Tijuana Brown was indicted. The voters overwhelmingly said no to her reelection. It will be interesting to see if these stories about the sheriff's office, if they break through to the common voter.
And there's a long period of time between now and March, unless something else emerges over that period of time. You mentioned that not a lot of people want to get involved in this, but there are a lot of people who want to get involved in something that happened back in August, the stabbing death of Irina Zarutska on the Blue Line train a month ago, August 22nd, I believe, has garnered national attention, and it will now result in a congressional committee taking a road trip to Charlotte. The House Judiciary Committee will hold a hearing here, I believe, on September 29th. How, Steve, how unusual is it for House committees to hold hearings outside of Washington and Capitol Hill?
I am no expert on Congress, but I can't think of another instance. I mean, it seems to me that this is highly unusual. I can't remember it ever happening in Charlotte before. The committee is chaired by Republican Jim Jordan of Ohio. We don't know really details about, we know what's going to be in Charlotte. We don't know where. But, you know, there's the story is continuing to play out both at the congressional level, in Raleigh, at the local level. This is still a very big deal 5 weeks later.
According to a publication called the Carolina Journal, the hearings will highlight recent criminal activity in the Queen City. That's a quote. This is not in reaction to the assassination of Charlie Kirk. We should point that out because this road trip was scheduled before his killing, his murder. And in confirming the committee's visit to Charlotte, Republican Congressman Mark Harris posted on X, "Justice is coming." Read into that what you will. And the chairman of the Oversight Subcommittee, Jeff Drew from New Jersey, says he is holding this hearing in Charlotte, quote, to expose a broken system that puts criminals first. This crime, as horrific as it was, Mary, appears to have been committed by an individual with mental health problems. His mother says he suffers from schizophrenia. She had him committed. They could only commit him for 14 days by law until they released him. When they released him into her custody. The family couldn't handle him. They gave him over to Roof Above, which is another organization that is not equipped to handle people with mental health problems. So is this a crime problem or is this a mental health problem?
Well, I think that it's all of a piece. When you have to fight crime, and he did commit this horrific crime, allegedly, he will have due process. But I believe before that, he's going to have a mental health evaluation. He had served time in prison for a previous crime. And when he came out, as you said, his mother said he had changed. I think one of the people that he is accused of assaulting was actually a sibling, a sister who didn't press charges ultimately because that's her brother, but he obviously was troubled. But this is all, let's face it, of a piece, particularly since it had that graphic video. Yeah. And we can't underestimate what the effect of that was. And it fits a narrative. And they're coming down here. And yes, they are concerned. I wonder if they will talk about different other things that have happened in Charlotte concentrate on this, because it does fit a narrative that Democrats are soft on crime and that Donald Trump, the president, is sending National Guard and other troops to democratically controlled cities that have a Democratic mayor, especially if that mayor happens to be Black. Let's face that. We also know that we have a very competitive Senate race that could actually determine which party controls the Senate. And we've already seen the likely GOP nominee, Michael Whatley, saying this is all Roy Cooper's fault, who's running as a Democrat for the Senate. And WFAE did a fact check, I believe, that said he has no relation to this whatsoever, but right. We are already seeing those things. So it is, yes, of concern, but also a part of this is political. And as you say, will they react by putting more money into mental health facilities and to try to help people? I mean, if you saw the video of him beforehand, he was talking to himself. And you've even had people try to make it a racial issue. like they're after us, things like that. When, as I said, it's clear that this man has problems. So well, they're going for first degree murder. They're charging him with a federal crime. I don't know how this will play out, but it's really interesting that it has become bigger than this, and it has become very political, as everything is nowadays.
All kinds of entities are trying to get involved in this. This incident is being investigated by the state auditor as well, who is looking into the public safety aspects of cats, including the money that they have earmarked over time for security. And next week, North Carolina House Speaker Destin Hall and Senate Leader Phil Berger say they plan to introduce legislation targeting crime. Berger wants to restart the death penalty, and he has been critical of task forces on crime created by the former governor, Roy Cooper, that he says advanced, quote, soft on crime policies that allowed Zarutska's suspected murderer to remain free. He did have 14 or so, the alleged perpetrator here did have 14, I think, earlier charges, and he was out on all of those charges. But the guidelines for options affording that magistrates can, the options that magistrates can take when they're confronting these cases are outlined by laws written by the Republican-controlled legislature. So did the system fail, or has the legislature failed to fund the district attorney's office and the courts and police, which they say they're all understaffed and they're not getting support in terms of money? Is that what happened? Or is it just all of these things coming together, Alex?
Yeah, I think it's all of those things coming together. I don't think we can just focus on mental health either, because if he goes to the courthouse and he's struggling with mental health and he's just kind of being cycled through there, I mean, somebody has to stop and say, like, whoa, this, we can't just put, like, close this case file and move on. Like, this guy is really struggling and we can't have him out there because he might hurt somebody. So I don't think it's just going to be a matter of, oh, we need like more counselors. I think it's going to be a very well-rounded solution that we need to address in the courthouse, in the police, mental health. Everything needs to be looked at. It can't be all this finger pointing with the politics. It's not helpful.
Mm. It's not helpful.
The U.S. Department of the U.S. Department of Transportation is also looking into Charlotte and the CAT system at a time, obviously, when they're trying to get the sales tax. So it's the state is looking into it. Federal government is looking into it. So we will see this hearing happen September 29th, I believe, but we don't have many details on it.
Eric, I have 20 seconds.
I was just going to say, locally, the business community, they seem to be looking a lot at magistrates, as you mentioned, but it is a confluence of factors, as everyone just outlined.
We still have more to talk about with regard to this train stabbing, because it has tentacles reaching out everywhere and coagulating, if that's the right word, here in Charlotte, and we'll take a look at those and more stories when we come back at Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on the local news roundup on WFAE and WFAE.org. Eric Spanberg is with us, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Alexandria Sands, a reporter for Axios. Charlotte, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. And Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter. As we mentioned, the legislature is looking into passing a series of new laws dealing with crime in light of what happened on the Blue Line back in August. And North Carolina Democratic State Representative Laura Budd says she is pushing for coordination and proper investment.
To execute this plan is going to require time and financial investment in the courts, public safety infrastructure, including our transit system. We need to upgrade and place officers on that transit system, have people pay for tickets. That alone may be a deterrent for some.
Steve, there are tons of people who ride the Blue Line and never buy a ticket. There are no turnstiles. It is an honor system. The man who allegedly murdered Ms. Zarutska was allegedly he did not buy a ticket to get on. But would a change in policy, just because you buy a ticket, does that make people safer?
I mean, just on its own, the idea that oh, if everyone has to have a ticket, we will prevent violent crime. I mean, that is not realistic. The idea is that we have multi-layered security, that if you need a ticket, you'll think twice about getting on without it. So that may deter you from riding. There, if you do get on, there may be security, et cetera. Just the idea that there are kind of a series of hurdles that you may encounter if you're a bad actor on the train or a bus. And I think there's a sense that over the last decade or so, many of those hurdles just went away almost entirely. And CATS is now trying to increase security. They said this week that they feel like their security plan is now, quote, fully operational.
Mecklenburg County Commissioner Lee Altman, at a meeting of the Metropolitan Transit Commission this week, advanced the idea of this stricter fare control on the light rail.
I think it would be good to make it very clear inside and outside that it's illegal to ride the train without paying a fare, and to consider not just allowing someone to pay the fare when they get busted, but having a consequence.
But Davidson Mayor Rusty Knox, who's on the Transit Commission, I believe, viewed that suggestion as a strange way to calm people's fears and make them feel safe.
I'm reminded, since it's the 50th anniversary of the movie Jaws coming out, of when the shark attack happened and nobody wanted to go in the water, and the mayor was urging one of his councilmen to go in the water, and he had such apprehension against doing so.
In other words, the mayor in Jaws was not telling the truth about the safety of going into the water, because the monster, the Jaws shark, was still out there, and there was no reason to be secure. There was reason to be afraid. But Knox added this.
We are a big city. We're a metropolitan area of 1.2 million people now. And crime happens everywhere. What happened to Irina Zarutska was so sad and tragic, and our community, our city, our county, having to shoulder that tragic event, it's tough on everyone. But I would tell people, public safety is safe.
I think, Steve, he meant to say that public transit is safe. I think he misspoke. But what is the difference? I don't know where that's coming from, but it's coming from somebody's computer. What's the difference in that comment and the one made by the mayor in Jaws, that it was safe to go back in the water? How do you convince people that it's safe? Because ridership is down.
Ridership is way down over the last 10 years since the pandemic. I think a lot of that is due, you know, to things like work from home and ride share. But I do think probably public safety has had an impact on ridership, that, you know, if you have an option, if you don't have to take the bus or the train, there are some people who have said, you know what, I don't feel comfortable. I'm going to drive. I'm going to find another way to work. And again, Mike, like you said, the Jaws reference was strange because, you know, in the movie, the mayor of Amity was trying to get people back in the water, and then he did, and then more people were eaten. I didn't understand where that was going.
Eric's been trying to get into this for 20 minutes. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, I didn't think we would be breaking down Jaws today, but here we are. Nobody mentioned Jaws 2, by the way. I think Steve hit on something.
And nobody should.
And nobody should. I think Steve hit on something that is really important and interesting about what was discussed at the Metropolitan Transit Commission, and just in general, the way the local conversation is going, which is they're talking about these fare zones. They're talking about now they have 20 full-time police officers, the equivalent, doing off-duty work on the blue line. They have the private security that has beefed up. All of these things are being put together to, as Steve said, add layers. So the idea is you can't make it absolutely foolproof, but you can certainly make it feel much more secure and deter people by having everyone aware that there are a lot more eyes watching a lot more often.
You can't prevent crime to everyone, everywhere, ever. That's not possible.
Right.
But you can do something that doesn't make you appear negligent, I suppose.
Right. And reduce.
CATS interim CEO Brett Cagle spoke about what you're just talking about right now, security staffing on the Blue Line, which is patrolled primarily by a third-party private security company.
The assigned officers for the blue line, there are no vacancies there. In addition to that, we have 800 hours a week of additional CMPD officers patrolling the blue line.
So he added that regular riders might not see the extra added security every day, but they will see them routinely. Alex, if these folks, these security folks, are not on the platform and on every train, will that be reassuring to riders?
I'm not sure. I know I tried to ask Katz about where they were going to put these officers, and they told me that would be revealing their safety plans, and they couldn't tell me that. But they said that they are going to be in key areas across the transit system. I think it would definitely make people feel better if they saw police and security guards. I got on the Gold Line like maybe 3 days after the stabbing and did not see a single security person. But I did see somebody get on the train and start screaming into the void about three seats down from me. I know on Monday they're also, Katz is apparently bringing some agreement before council where it's going to allow them to somehow expand the authority that they have over security.
Steve, did you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I just, you know, what Alex said about her getting on the Gold Line streetcar and not seeing security, you know, during all of the public meetings and debate about security, there's obviously been a lot of focus on the Lynx Blue Line where the murder occurred. But, you know, people on the city council and the Metropolitan Transit Commission never say, like, well, what are we doing about the Gold Line? They're both trains. They're both premier transit products that the city is very proud of. And, you know, it's hard because for a long time, the security focus for the last couple of years was on the main bus station downtown and on buses. Now we shift to the blue line. Everyone seems to be ignoring the Gold Line streetcar. Maybe that's not actually what's happening on the ground, but in terms of the elected officials, totally not on their radar.
We mentioned that Democrats are being accused by Republicans of being soft on crime, and although State Representative Laura Budd had some suggestions, which I'm going to play in a second, for this, they may make her be part of that group of people who appear to be soft on crime because she has an alternative suggestion for the legislature.
Let's fund no less than 5,000 more local police officers across the state to deploy across our cities and our counties to help protect and serve and create a sense of public safety, restoring it where it may have been damaged or lost.
So this murder hasn't only been a focus in Washington and Raleigh and locally. Officials here have been talking about it ad nauseum, especially as November's vote on the referendum for a one-cent sales tax for transit approaches. The comments you just heard from Lee Altman, from Rusty Knox, from Brett Cagle, all came from a meeting at which Mecklenburg County commissioners voted to approve several agreements to create a new Metropolitan Transit Commission should voters say yes to the one-cent sales tax referendum. Steve, remind us why we need a new commission.
The idea is that we eventually, if the voters approve the transit tax, we would like other counties to join in someday. Union County passes its own tax, then they could join and become a member of a new transit authority, kind of its own special government. Right now, there's no mechanism for that to happen. So they want to hit the ground running if voters approve the tax. So right now, if you want to serve on the 27-member board that will govern the authority, applications are open and they run through, I think, Election Day or shortly thereafter.
So Meg Fensel with Sustain Charlotte was at the meeting and urged commissioners to vote yes on the creation of the new commission.
Public transit is foundational to building a sustainable and vibrant Mecklenburg County. It connects people to jobs, education, healthcare, and opportunity while reducing traffic congestion and emissions.
And commissioners, in fact, voted 8-1. To move this forward with a new transit authority. Only Susan Rodriguez McDowell voted no. Eric, why?
Why did they vote no?
Why did Susan Rodriguez McDowell?
She's just against the plan in general. She has opposed the whole thing. Can I answer? Oh, go ahead.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to add, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned the referendum. One of the things that came up at the Metropolitan Transit Commission this week is this idea that if you pass the amendment to raise the tax, I'm sorry, if you pass the referendum to raise the tax, then with that $19.4 billion over 30 years, some of that money can go to enhanced public safety, perhaps a CATS police force of its own. And so that is something that has also crept into the political and policy discussion coming out of this.
So a grand jury returned a murder indictment for DeCarlos Brown, the man charged in the stabbing of Irina Zarutska. His attorney has filed for a competency evaluation, which we've already mentioned. And to cap off this topic, I guess, Charlotte native and rapper DaBaby has released a music video that tells the story of this stabbing death.
You think you can save me? Oh, you think you can save
what?
Me?
Think you could save me like you got or something? I've been put about the way, I ain't been starting nothing. I done spent a couple million on them lawyer fees. Cause when you really stand on business, it's gonna cost some money.
So this video is called Save Me. It recreates the attack with DaBaby stopping the attacker at the end of the video and then escorting the actor playing the attacker off the light rail train. And Alex, you reported on this. That was real because... evidently, they didn't get permission to shoot this video on the train, and security was escorting them all off. Correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, CATS. We asked CATS about it because we were like, "Wow, where'd they get these really realistic CATS security uniforms?" So we asked CATS about it, and they said that they got someone submitted on the app that there was a safety concern, and then security came, showed up, and escorted them off the light rail because they had just kind of showed up with their cameras, and they filmed the whole thing successfully, and then they used that part at the end of the video.
A video no one wanted, I would say.
Okay, we have to wrap this up very quickly, but I want to mention that we have a winner in District 5, the city council race. After a recount, it was a real squeaker, by the way, after a recount, newcomer J.D. Mazura Arias won the seat from the, was it three-term incumbent or two-term incumbent?
Two-term.
Marjorie Molina. What was the final tally, Steve?
The final tally was 34 votes out of about 6,000 cast. There was a few provisional ballots were counted. And then Councilmember Molina requested a recount, and that actually added one vote to J.D. Masuera Arias's tally. And then Councilmember Molina conceded earlier this week after a really, really bitter election fight. I mean, it was one that on social media she said was evil, a really harsh word. But this race is over.
Based on what?
It was one of the big things in this race was the union, the Service Employees International Union, spent a lot of money to defeat her. Canvassers, mailers, because she had voted against studying earlier this year ways to improve the working conditions and pay of contract workers at the airport. So the SEIU went all in to defeat her. They were successful by, you know, like you said, a very narrow margin. And she felt under attack the entire race.
So that means that Arias, who will have no Republican challenger in November, will be on city council as of December. And we should mention that WFAE staff member Julian Berger is J.D. Mazura Arias' partner. Julian is not involved in any coverage of the District 5 race or that of Charlotte City Council. Let's end with some relatively good news. Charlotte FC started strong this season. They had a slump. Now they have tied a MLS league record with 9 wins in a row, the longest in league history, and they set the franchise record for points with 4 matches yet to play. Here's Coach Dean Smith.
Credit to them for what they've been doing. Now have become record holders in this league. 9 on the spin, takes some doing. Not many teams get to do that in any league. You know, but they've got the chance to try and own it now next week. And that was the message to them.
Let's show Oliver how to do it, my dears. That's what it sounds like. Saturday, they may say. They may set a new league record with 10 wins in a row, and they play New York City in New York. Will they? Won't they, Eric?
Oh, let's be optimistic and say they will. But, Mike, what a season, and we have had so little of this in Charlotte. Rare is the moment that we can say a team is cruising into the playoffs, but Charlotte FC is doing just that.
And perhaps if they do well on Saturday, some of them can suit up as Panthers on Sunday. You won't be able to recognize them with the helmets and the gears. No one will know. So maybe they could help us win against Atlanta, their favorite to win on Sunday here at home. Steve Harrison from WFAE News, Alexandria Sands from Axios Charlotte, Mary C. Curtis from RollCall.com at Equal Time, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.